KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You know, having to defend your work often makes your work better. So I don't think that here's a lot of money, go make your thing is necessarily the best way.
As creator of the series Fargo, Noah Hawley has sometimes had to justify his creative decisions to his network, FX. But for him, that process makes sense. Hawley tells us why he's not convinced the Netflix strategy is the best for making TV shows and hints at what's in store for season 3 of Fargo. But first on the news banter, Emmy nominations. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Michael Schneider of IndieWire and Variety. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Kim.
So you were closely watching the Emmy race and the nominations came out. Really, people were pleased. The critics that I read, they are all very pleased that in feeling that the so-called rubber stamp nominations, while still present, still some shows that a lot of people love, like Modern Family in there, but, you know, have been in there and in there and in there, but room for a lot of new shows this year. HBO is still dominating with Game of Thrones, but right behind it is FX with some very original stuff, and right behind them is Netflix, and it's a very diverse and interesting field.
Yeah, they're spreading the love around, which is really nice. You know, what's frustrating is that there's still only 7 positions in the outstanding comedy and drama categories when, as we know, there are dozens of fantastic TV shows, all of which probably deserve to be included. But when you look at the list, especially for comedy, drama, and limited series, you can't argue against most of these shows. I love the fact in comedy series, you have shows like Master of None, which is Aziz Ansari's show, getting some love. Blackish, which had an amazing season, sneaking in there.
Absolutely.
In addition to shows that are returning, like Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and Veep, which was last year's winner, Transparent. I mean, you can't argue really with this list. And then you look at the drama side, it's sort of the same thing. Adding in Mr. Robot and The Americans, that cheer you heard on Thursday, where TV critics up and down America cheering that The Americans finally got some love from the TV Academy, and Mr. Robot, one of the best new shows on television, also getting some love its first season out. So that's also a fantastic category. Game of Thrones, of course, dominates there and probably will win again. But, you know, you can't argue with those shows as well.
Yeah, this is the first year that the voting has been online only, and there were more people voting. And you have to wonder whether that transition to online opened the door for some of these voters who might not have participated in the past.
Oh, I think it absolutely did. And that was one of the big issues that the Emmys really kind of managed to fix over the past couple of years, is opening up the door, not only adding more members, but also adding younger members, adding more diverse members, sort of what the Oscars are now trying to do. The Emmys sort of had a running start. And as a result, you see a much more diverse nominated body of actors and actresses, in addition to a diverse amount of TV shows.
Yeah, now there were some people overlooked, as you well know. For example, James Corden nominated, but Stephen Colbert, who's had a lot of run of being nominated for his show on Comedy Central, overlooked.
Yeah, that's a little embarrassing, obviously, inside CBS, but clearly James Corden has the buzz right now with his, you know, Carpool Karaoke, which was even nominated as a special. So he's got a lot of love right now in the community. And you know, what's interesting also, you mentioned Stephen Colbert, you know, Colbert Report and The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, the past several years sort of alternated winning that award for Variety Talk. This year, obviously, with both of them gone, Comedy Central was completely shut out of that category for the first time since the year 2000. So that's a real changing of the guard.
Yeah, more good news for Viacom, right? in the middle of all of this. Moving on to, like, just analyze a little bit about what we really felt was great or not great. For me, I was just very pleased to see a lot of shows nominated, as we talked about just now. People versus O.J. Simpson was so excellent. And I look at that category, it's up against Fargo and American Crime and, you know, you just sort of say, and Roots and The Night Manager, but those are some pretty strong shows. But I just think it was great to see FX rewarded for taking a chance on something so bold and original.
Yeah, FX's 56 nominations is the most ever, not only for FX, but for any basic cable network, which is a huge deal. But obviously with monsters like People vs. O.J. and Fargo, you know, justly deserved. And you look at, you know, the actors that were nominated from People vs. O.J., Sterling K. Brown, David Schwimmer, John Travolta, Sarah Paulson, the list goes on. This is a fantastic group of actors. And yeah, it's going to be now an interesting fight to see who actually comes out with Emmy Gold.
Yeah, I know you were among those who was especially pleased to see the Americans nominated. Anything else that you particularly would like to say the Emmys got right this time, the nominations?
Yeah, like you mentioned, the Americans and Mr. Robot in the drama categories. You know, and you know, honestly, I like that they mixed up you know, all the acting categories as well. You know, some great shows that got some attention, including The Night Manager at AMC, got some love for Hugh Laurie. You have shows like American Crime getting some love, Regina King, who's amazing, Brooklyn Nine-Nine gets some love, Veep, of course, for fantastic actors like Tony Hale and Matt Walsh. And sadly, we said goodbye to Key and Peele, but at least Keegan-Michael Key will get one final chance at Emmy Gold as well. So keeping my fingers crossed for some of my favorites.
Of course, I'm still a little annoyed by some of the perennials. I know people, some people still really, truly adore those shows, but some of that just feels a bit lazy to me. I mean, does Downton Abbey need to be nominated yet again? And, you know, I watched somewhat reluctantly, but I was in, but again. And, you know, I also feel like some of these nominees, notably Seinfeld for his Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. I mean, really? Is that the thing that should be competing with people who are doing more of a performance? You know, I think certain people, including our colleague Joe Adalian, have complained about that.
Yeah, and I think that was a little unusual to see that surrounded by all the traditional talk shows there, and that meant that it shut out you know, great new talent, you know, like Samantha Bee, whose show Full Frontal I thought might have been a lock just because she's having such a great buzzy year in this political season.
Yeah, Full Frontal got one nomination in writing, but yes, I agree, quite an oversight. I assume it will be corrected at some point. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
That's Michael Schneider of IndieWire and Variety. Among those just nominated for Emmy this year is our guest today, writer-producer Noah Hawley, creator of the FX limited series Fargo. This is the second nomination for the show in as many seasons. In 2014, Fargo won for Outstanding Miniseries. Hawley is nominated for writing, as he was in the previous season, and this time also for directing. Fargo takes its tone from the 1996 Coen Brothers movie. It takes place in the same bleak, frigid Midwestern setting and shares the same dark humor. The narrative is not linear. Season 2, set in 1979, was a prequel to Season 1. The ensemble cast from the most recent season included Emmy nominees Kirsten Dunst, Jesse Plemons, Gene Smart, and breakout Bokeem Woodbine. He plays a hitman named Mike Milligan, who at one point finds himself in a Midwestern-style standoff with Minnesota State Trooper Lou Salverson, played by Patrick Wilson.
I like you. Met another fellow from Minnesota yesterday. Big guy. Sheriff, I think. I liked him, too.
We're very friendly people.
No. That's not it. Pretty unfriendly, actually. But it's the way you're unfriendly. How you're so polite about it. Like you're doing me a favor.
Hawley has been writing for TV for more than a decade. He got his start on the Fox crime procedural Bones and created the series The Unusuals and My Generation for ABC. These days, he makes his TV home at FX. In addition to overseeing the forthcoming third season of Fargo, he's also executive producing Legion, based on the Marvel comic book character of the same name. But Hawley doesn't stick to TV. Earlier this summer, he released his fifth novel, a mystery thriller called Before the Fall. When he sat down with Michael Schneider and Joe Adalian, hosts of the KCRW podcast The Spinoff, he had a simple explanation for how he gets so much writing done.
I found a rift in the space-time continuum, and I go there and work for years on scripts and then come back into our time and space, and we make them.
And it's the first question that I know anyone asks you. So you have a standard answer by now when people ask you just how you get it all done?
No, I don't really, except that, you know, the writing is, at this point, it's a craft, right? And I've trained. I'm a 20-year overnight success. So, you know, instinctually, I'm a good first draft writer, and I write quickly. And, you know, if you do the work in advance, in breaking story, et cetera, then, you know, sitting down to write is the fun part. But I don't know. If you make me think about it too much, it stresses me out.
Right, so, right. Okay. Yeah. But congrats on your new novel, Before the Fall, which you're even going to write the film adaptation for Sony.
Yeah, in the space-time continuum rift, I'm already writing it.
In a project like this, do you at all consider whether or not it might be appropriate for TV? I mean, obviously there are things that lend themselves to episodic TV, right? And so maybe Before the Fall does not lend itself to that. But you possibly could have done this, maybe I would imagine, as a 6-hour or 4-hour event series. I'm just wondering why film over TV?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. You know, I think there's, you know, quantitatively a money difference in what the film studios will pay for a book and what television will pay for a book. You know, at a certain point, if a book takes off, you know, in this town, it takes on a life of its own that kind of takes TV out of the equation on that level. You know, on another level, I am attracted to playing with, you know, the 2-hour movie at this point. There's certainly a great 10-hour movie in this book in which you can explore all the characters and themes. But the challenge is, how do you do in a 2-hour movie what I like to do in a 10-hour movie, which is how do you make it not just a plot delivery device? And how do you create something unpredictable? So all the challenges that by stretching the story out and weaving in and out of the main narrative that you can do in TV, the challenge now is to say, well, how do we do that with a film?
So you want to work some muscles you don't get to work with some of your other work.
Yeah, put my money where my mouth is. And, you know, I mean, I'm a big believer in economy. And I also feel like the cliche that a picture is worth 1,000 words is true, and that you can show those images that can do what it would take a chapter to do.
Well, it's got to be tough adapting your own project because, you know, every word is your baby. That sounds difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I'm never precious about things. And even, you know, going from a script to into production and into the editing room, I mean, by the time I get into the editing room, it's the last time you write the story and all bets are kind of off. And you know, so a lot of times scenes will change order. And, you know, for example, in the second year of Fargo, in the script, when Rye Gerhardt gets run over by a car. In the script, you know, Peggy got out of the car and we saw her and then we went home directly with her. But then in the editing room, it seemed really interesting to me to hit him with the car and have the car drive away without knowing who was driving it. And then there's sort of this mystery, this tension to it. So I'm never so attached to something that I'm not clear-headed about, like, is there a better version of this?
Yeah, well, this gives you an opportunity to do a second version.
Yeah, and also to decide, like, to boil the story down to its most essential parts and to realize that, you know, all these other pieces, those are interesting, but let's follow this one tangent.
I wonder, as we talk about this project, if we're striking fear in the hearts of FX execs who are like, hey, Noah, you're on the clock now. You've got a couple things brewing over here. Let's, you know, let's get back to Legion. Let's get back to Fargo season 3.
Yeah, well, like a lot of things in the Fargo world, it's a conversation that goes unhad, but is definitely a subtext to, you know, to the work, which is just I'm busy, and not only am I busy with Fargo, but I'm doing another show for FX as well that we shot the first hour, and we'll go back and start shooting in August. So I have to shoot 7 more hours of that before we shoot Fargo. So yeah, there's a lot to do.
And let's talk about Legion. There's been a lot of attention on this, partly because it sort of deals with the X-Men world,
right.
And that's something that's been brewing for quite a while and finally coming to fruition.
Yeah, it took a long time. And actually, you know, I first engaged with FX about it, you know, right after we wrapped season 1 of Fargo. So it took, you know, from initial conversation to air date will be over 2 years, I think. It's an 8-episode order, which was my request that we do 8 instead of 10, because I felt like I wanted to try to tell a complete story, a chapter, and it mapped out over 8 hours instead of 10. And, you know, the show is an experiment on some level, and we are playing with tone and with structure, and there is a lot to take in with it. It's not an information delivery device. It's an experience delivery device. And so, you know, I sort of feel like give people a digestible chunk for the first year and make sure that this is a show that people respond to and that we're successful with. And then, you know, in a second year, we could do a larger order.
You know, right now, everything you're doing is for FX or cable, maybe just exclusively FX, I think. But where do you stand right now in terms of working for broadcast TV? I talk to a lot of creators these days, actors, who honestly, if they can avoid it, they just don't have much of a desire to go to broadcast TV. Do you see yourself working in that medium again?
I can't really imagine working in broadcast again, mostly just because experimentation is so important to me, and there is a kind of irreverence that I feel for the rules of how you tell a story, as well as, you know, there's just such a fear-based business, the broadcast business. And look, I did 2 shows for ABC, and I fought as hard as I could to make them great. But, you know, you can't make something great. The first show, The Unusuals, wanted to be a cop show where the cases solved the characters and played with tone, et cetera. And then the second show was a fake documentary told in 2 time periods. And, you know, I feel like broadcast, they want originality and they'll buy something original. And then the fear kicks in and then they try to turn it into something familiar. So my generation had to be a soap. That's how they saw it. It's what it had to be. And it was just really hard to get them to let me do what I instinctually felt like the show should do.
And my generation, I remember, it was Thursdays at 8, right? Which is
it was a tough
time slot.
Yeah, that was a crazy. That we went in 8 days. We went from being the flagship show of the fall season. And then Steve McPherson left and Paul Lee came in. And we premiered and the numbers weren't great. They'd moved Big Bang Theory against us, and it was the kill zone Thursday night at 8.
Yeah.
And then a week later, we were canceled.
You'd produced 10 episodes at that point already. And they just never were seen. The other night.
You know, that was the year of, what was that, Lone Star? It was Kyle Killen went first, and then I was second.
Right.
And then, you know, they replaced us with repeats of Grey's Anatomy that did no better. You know, and they've learned, I think. They've sort of stopped doing that now they just kind of let things play out. Because they paid for them and they made them, and what else are you going to replace them with? So I'm not a greedy guy. Like, I don't want to go to broadcast to get a bigger paycheck for myself. And my ambition is only to tell the best stories that I can tell. So I would be very skeptical in going, you know, into broadcast again to, you know, because the notes, it's a crazy process.
You know, also, you've now sort of had enough success under your belt that you could probably go wherever you want to go. I mean, you've got this great relationship with FX, and you're at a point now where you're not sort of dictated by timetables anymore.
I accidentally stumbled upon a formula for making Fargo that, you know, has managed to survive, which is we write the show and then we film the show. And the first year it was because they picked the show up in December and it's a winter show, so we literally couldn't shoot it for a year. Therefore, I said, okay, well, now I have time. I'll write all of them. And that became the way we made the show. And then, you know, we won the awards that we won. And then I was able to say, well, great. So if we want to do all that again, like, let's just repeat it. Let me write them all and, you know, separate writing from production. And, you know, the great thing about working with FX and MGM on Fargo, but also FX on Legion, is they're open to the idea. If I tell them that 8 episodes is better than 10, even though they're going to make less money off of 8 episodes, they'll make 8 episodes. And the decisions are driven by what's best creatively for the show. And, you know, I'd be reluctant to go anywhere else unless I felt like that would continue.
Coming up after a short break, Holly talks about how to stand out in the era of peak TV and why he thinks binging a show is not necessarily the best way to watch. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're listening to a conversation with Noah Hawley, creator of the FX series Fargo. The storyline for season two of the dramedy had its roots in a conversation from season one. Fans will remember Keith Carradine as Lou Salverson, who shares vivid memories from his years as a state trooper with a patron at his diner. Unbeknownst to Lou, he's talking to killer for hire Lauren Malvo, played by Billy Bob Thornton.
Had a case once. Back in 79. I'd tell you the details, but it sounded like I made them up. Madness, really.
Bodies?
Yes, sir. One after another. Probably, if you stacked them high, could have climbed to the second floor.
When Hawley was writing season one, he knew many viewers would encounter the show months or even years after it was first released and would probably binge it. But he was happy to have his show run on a traditional once-a-week schedule as opposed to dropping the entire season at once, as would have happened if it were a Netflix series.
I'm not convinced that that's the best way to do it. You know, the thing with Netflix and a lot of the streaming services is you watch an episode, and then if you do nothing for 10 seconds, it'll play you another episode. And there is this sort of fugue state, I feel like, that as a viewer you get into when you watch too much of something. It becomes a much more passive experience. And so what I would do is I would create a certain moment of dislocation, which would snap you out of that, because suddenly you had to sit forward and go, okay, wait, what's going on now? Who are these people? Because otherwise you just sort of zone out, was my feeling. And, you know, I want you to pay attention. I want you to think about, I want to engage the audience's imagination, which is not what a filmed medium normally does.
That's one of the side effects of peak TV, as Mr. Landgraf is fond to bring up.
My personal philosophy is if there's 400 shows on TV, the only reason to make another one is if you think it can be the best show on TV. But it's hard. There's so many things on right now that are really good that, you know, no one has ever heard of. So how do you cut through? That's the trick, and I think that's why ultimately it will have to contract, because, you know, is it worth all the money we're spending? Is everyone making money off of all this TV? It's yet to be seen, I think.
Another question I wanted to ask you, going back to, you know, sort of the Netflix of it all and the creative freedom that showrunners have over there, is there such a thing as too much creative freedom? I mean, you talked about the broadcast network notes process, but what's sort of the right role for networks? When should they step in and give some guidance?
You know, my personal feeling is that there are two notes that are meaningful. One is this is confusing, right? And not the sort of clarity overall, but this is confusing in that, wait, who's that guy or what's happening? And then the other is, I know what you're going for, but I don't think you got it. Thematically, character-wise, like, I know that you want this relationship moment to be big, but I don't think it's landing right. A note is not, I would do it differently. You know what I mean? That's mm-hmm. not a note. That's like, it's my show, and this is the story that I'm telling. But I think that those two valid notes are very important. And writing is an act of communication. And sometimes you're so far in a story that you need an objective person to say, or even just to question what you're doing so that you can articulate why you're doing it, which I think, you know, having to defend your work often makes your work better. So I don't think that here's a lot of money, go make your thing, is necessarily the best way.
Right, right. Well, in season one, you know, Lou mentions Sioux Falls, South Dakota. At that point, did you know that you were going to sort of go back and explore that in season two?
Not the first time he mentioned it, but then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, if we are going to do another one, it might be nice to lay in a couple more mentions of it and then go and tell that story. And maybe not even in a second year, maybe in a third year we would go and tell that story. And so in the ninth and tenth hour, he added some more references to it. So at that point, I was pretty clear that I was telling that story. That didn't necessarily mean I knew what that story was. I just knew that I was going to set it up.
For you, what was that process like of creating that universe? And was that a singular experience, or was that you open up and everyone pitches you ideas? How did you put that together? And how long did that take to sketch that universe?
Yeah, it's a dialogue. You know, the first year we had 12 weeks in a room, and then I started writing. The second year, 12 weeks sort of turned into 16 weeks because I would give the network outlines, and then we would need time to respond to their notes. And the second year was harder. There was this ghost in the room of the first year. And again, it's one thing for everybody to agree that we're going to throw out the story and start again, but it's another thing to say this story that's completely different from this other story is also the same show. You know what I mean? Like that, there's a level of really that is just inherent in the process. And for me as a creator, for me as the guy with the vision, I know it's going to land, and I know it's going to be as emotional, and it's going to feel at the end of the day, it's going to feel like Fargo. But there were definitely moments, you know, where I would get notes, it doesn't feel as emotional as the first year, or the sense of all the moving pieces and who are these people really? And you know, even in the production process on those first couple of hours, we had some issues in that first episode and had to go back and reshoot a bunch of things. And so I sort of, the first cut that I showed, the network didn't work. But I had to show them the version that didn't work so that I could get money to reshoot.
You also give them a lot of Bruce Campbell as Ronald Reagan early yes. on, which I'm sure confused a lot of
Well, you know, I like to joke that the, you know, my friends at MGM came to take me to lunch while we were breaking story for the second season, and they said, "Well, what can you tell us about year two?" And I said, "Well, we're going to make two fake Ronald Reagan movies and there's a UFO." And they said, "No, really, what can you tell us about the second year?" So there was a lot of that, and it was a more kind of inventive and playful year, and I was trusting the audience. I'd seen from the first year that you can do a parable sequence, and you can have fish fall from the sky, and you can have these accept the mystery elements yeah. in there. And I didn't want to, like, you know, overwhelm people with them, but I was trying to tell a story now at a higher level. It's like, okay, if the audience will go with me here, will they go with me here? And you know, until you see it fully executed, until you see it cut together with the split screens and the music and those performances. I mean, who knew that Bokeem Woodbine would be that? You know,
yeah.
I didn't.
So amazing.
I cast
yeah.
him. He auditioned. But when he showed up that first day and opened his mouth and that was who Mike Milligan was, that was really exciting. So, you know, this year's room is longer even, I think, total 20 weeks probably. But I have a script, one script, and we've broken the whole thing and we're all about to start writing.
So we don't know much so far, but we do know that Ewan McGregor is going to play brothers.
He will. He'll play himself and someone else.
Anything else you could tell us?
Well, you know, like the first 2 years, there's a catalyst to the story. It's not a woman with a man in her windshield, and it's not two men in an emergency room, but there is a sort of original feud between these two brothers that becomes the driving force that puts things in motion. You know, what I always loved about the movie Fargo is that it's not a whodunit, right? There's no mystery. You meet the people before the crime is committed, and then when the crime is committed, you meet your law enforcement, as it would be in real life, and then you follow everybody going forward through the story. So, you know, these brothers will have a lot to do with, you know, the crime of the year, and then, you know, we have at first one female cop come in, and then a second, and, you know, it's a little bit of running around Minnesota again. But it isn't a story on the same scale. It's not a gang war story. It's a more intimate and character-driven year.
Will any character have Sulverson as their last name, or will it be a little more subtle, the connection this
yeah,
time?
Yeah, it's a little more tangential, I think. I mean, there are thematic connections, but the literal connection or characters, it's more of a tangential.
That was Michael Schneider and Joe Adalian speaking to Noah Hawley. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business. To see what condition my condition was in.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.